Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hello and welcome to Read Like a Writer, the books podcast from Faber & Faber, Serpent's Tale and Canongate, three independent publishers, bringing you the voices and the recommendations from your favourite authors. In each episode, we'll hear about the books and the bookshops closest to these writers' hearts. I'm Anna Fielding and with me in the studio today is Matt Haig. Matt has written many books covering fiction for adults and children, memoir and factual titles. His 2015 memoir, Reasons to Stay Alive, made him a prominent voice on the topic of mental health, especially in relation to men and masculinity. Matt has started and contributed to some very important conversations on this topic and others, and his ability to convey empathy through the written word mean that he's greatly trusted and loved by readers. Much of Matt's work is about examining what it means to be a human being. In his latest book, Notes on a Nervous Planet, Matt describes us all as thinking, feeling, art-making, knowledge-hungry, marvellous animals. And we'll be covering thinking, feeling and art and knowledge as we go on. But for the moment, from one marvellous animal to another, hello, Matt.
Hello, Anna. It's very nice to be here. It's nice to chat today.
Yes, yeah, it's nice to be in the air conditioning, as
Absolutely.
We were just saying earlier.
It's quite a hot day out there.
So, hot day outside, still is July. Your book, Notes on a Nervous Planet, has just been published. It's non-fiction. I was wondering if you could talk us through the main themes.
I didn't really plan to write Notes on a Nervous Planet. After my book, Reasons to Stay Alive, I was almost scared off writing again about mental illness because I did something like 50 events for Reasons to Stay Alive where I was just talking about sort of like the worst experience of my life, like a nervous breakdown in my 20s over and over again. So I sort of retreated into other stuff, other books. I wrote a book about Father Christmas and a book about a 439-year-old man. And I was going as far away from reality as possible. And I didn't think I had anything else to say. And I certainly didn't want to write Reasons to Stay Alive 2 or anything like that. But Notes on a Nervous Planet, I started to realise that one of the things that was helping me as time grew on was understanding how much my own health, my mental health, is connected to how I live. And during this time, there was a lot of research being done into the effects of not just social media, but all aspects of how people live in our sort of ever-changing century and how rates of anxiety, particularly among young people, millennials and younger, are rocketing, eating disorders, all kinds of different things. And I just realized we're at this crisis point where although we're sort of vaguely aware of it, it's on the periphery of our kind of thinking, we're not doing enough to actually realize that mental health is as cultural as physical health. I mean, no one would argue that, for instance, there are ways about how we live that affect our physical health, whether it's eating fast food or a sedentary lifestyle or passive smoking, whatever.
Lack of cholera or the invention of penicillin.
Well, indeed, exactly. It's all cultural. And a lot of things to do with technology are great and they're great advancements, but there's also sometimes a psychological fallout from it.
I mean, it's come up, I think some of the themes you mentioned, you called the ever-changing century and the use of art and humanity as a kind of defence against that. And it comes up in Notes on a Nervous Planet, the idea of disconnecting and embracing something that is true and beautiful. But actually, there's something, you said you didn't want to repeat yourself. I don't think you do repeat yourself. But there are these themes that come through in your fiction as well. Tom, the central character in How to Stop Time, as you say, is centuries old, and he has watched so many things change. But one of the things that causes him a lot of anxiety is the ever-increasing speed of change. Mm. And then you have, is it Audrey in Echo Boy, which was your teen science fiction novel. And she has this wonderful quote, which I'm just going to try.
Oh, wow. And I don't think anyone's ever quoted Echo Boy at me, so this might be a first.
Oh, well, there you go. I have it. It's a moat made of thoughts that are nothing to do with technology, she says.
Right.
And it's her father's way of saying her defence against the robots.
Yes.
So there are these little things that come up again and again. Is it something that preoccupies you a lot?
I think so. I mean, partly because I'm quite addicted to technology myself. Anyone who follows me on Twitter thinks, you know, who am I to write a book about, telling people the dangers of social media? So I'm definitely not writing it from the high ground. I'm not writing it as someone who is living in the Himalayas, you know, disconnected and not watching Netflix. And, you know, I'm someone sort of writing it from inside the storm, as it were, and trying to work out myself, you know, how much I need these things, how much I don't need these things. I mean, I think there's some positive aspects. I think if I'd, in 1999, when I first became ill with mental health stuff, I think it would have been quite good in some ways to have access to the internet, because I'd have been able to understand myself better. I'd have been able to find other people on social media with similar symptoms. So I'm definitely not telling anyone not to do these things or change their life. It's just about being aware of how we use it. You know, it's like no one would recommend, sitting in bed all day eating strawberry ice cream. But I think everyone should eat strawberry ice cream.
That's it, exactly.
That makes some kind of sense.
I think what we have in Notes on a Nervous Planet is, I think you needed to be immersed in it, actually, because it's, as you say, it's mindfulness. And I think you need a lot of awareness of the topic in order to write about it from the inside, because we're all inside it now. Anyone who picks up this book is in a very similar space to you. So I feel that perhaps you needed to be in the eye of the storm in order to look out and be able to observe it properly.
I hope so. And I think the whole idea is that we're kind of all in the storm. And like, you know, Notes on a Nervous Planet, the title, the nervousness isn't just because we're all nervous. It's because the planet itself is so connected now. Even back in the 19th century, when we had the first sort of transatlantic telegraph cables under the Atlantic Ocean, the guy who put them there talked about the world's nervous system. And now that nervous system has obviously evolved to an extent where it's almost like we're acting like individual neurons within the big sort of hive brain, which can be great, and it can create all kinds of wonderful change in the world. But at the same time, it can, on an individual level, cause all kinds of stress as well.
It's a really interesting metaphor that you go into with that one. It's almost like the world's nervous system is developing and growing its own brain, and then we're only a few steps away from the singularity, which you also mention.
Yeah, and that's, you know, collective psychology, and how sometimes I'll be arguing with someone, and I'm arguing with someone who's the opposite of me, who's got the opposing political views, but actually emotionally, psychologically, we'll be mirroring each other, and we'll be feeling the same tightness in our chest and anger at the keyboard and stuff, and probably from the aliens' cosmic perspective, seeing just this hot, angry energy coming from our technology.
Lighting up at different points as the...
Yes.
No, I can see that. Now, you told The Guardian in an interview last year that books were a safe space for the mind, getting off technology for a second.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered if you could expand on that.
I think... Well, it was a literal thing here, because like when I've been at my most anxious or most depressed, one of the only sort of cultural forms that's been available to me in those states has been books, because even I can remember being ill with panic disorder, and even if it was sort of evening time and I'd be reading a magazine, that would interfere with my sleep. It'd be overstimulating my brain when you're in that sort of state of deep sort of sensitivity. But I feel like now we're so bombarded from all sides with marketing messages, Instagram, lives that we're not living, and everything's sort of overloaded. I feel like books, because they're technology, but they're a 5,000-year-old technology. They're a kind of retreat from that just in themselves. So I'm not saying they're not intense things. I'm saying they're deeply intense things, but they're intense in a way that is different to the instant sort of disposable nature of a lot of social media and stuff.
It's true, actually. When you're really immersed in something, you do go into that kind of almost limbic state where you can kind of see what's happening, and it pulls your brain into a different sort of set of patterns, doesn't
Yes, definitely. And I'm actually a big fan of, like, white space. I think there's just something calming about, especially a real... I don't want to be one of those people who just talk about the smell of books or anything, but just the real physicality of a book. There's something tactile and comforting about it.
So talking of physical books, for every Read Like a Writer podcast, we ask our guests to choose a selection of their favourite books and from one of their favourite independent bookshops. Now, Matt, you've chosen City Books in Brighton, which is the city you live in. Mm-hmm. So I take it you visit a lot.
I do. I live literally, probably I can get there in less than 10 minutes. It's closer to our old house, but we've just moved a bit further up the hill. But yes, City Books is on Western Road in Brighton. I think technically it's over the border into Hove, but it's sort of between Hove and Brighton. And for those people who know Brighton, probably know that Western Road isn't necessarily the best or calmest shopping street in the world. It's quite a sort of chaotic, messy, average urban shopping street, really. But City Books almost acts like a book itself because it is a kind of retreat from the sort of craziness of the stuff around it. And it's quite a relatively small shop, but it's stacked with books. I've got so much there. Fiction, non-fiction, children's, adults, and they do lots of events as well. And I've done events not there inside the shop. I think I've done a signing inside the shop, but they're very innovative in the venues they use around Brighton. I did one in the Rope Tackle Art Centre, which is just Stramber Road in Shoreham. They've done one with Caroline Lucas, I think, in the Brighton Dome. And, you know, so they've got big sort of grand ambitions, but they operate out of this lovely, lovely little bookshop, which is chaotic in a sort of very lovable way.
So walk me through your typical trip to City Books. What happens when you walk in the door?
Well, I think as soon as you walk in, I think the bell goes on the door, and then you've got the cash register and the people, the friendly, very friendly people behind the desk as you walk in. So you're instantly greeted. It's the kind of shop that you can't really go to without ending up in a nice conversation about books. And there's always people in there, often children on the floor reading a book, but it's very sort of wall-to-wall, probably about 10 rows of shelves, 10 all around. And I'm thinking the children's book section is at the back of the store, and they've always got lovely sort of full window displays as well. And they do nice Christmas events where they get a local author, because obviously in Brighton you've got quite a lot of local authors there.
Spoilt for choice down there, really, aren't you?
Quite a few, especially lots of children's book people and illustrators and stuff. And, you know, they'll get the sherry out and mince pies and stuff. And, yeah, it's just a really, really nice... I mean, there's quite a few... We're spoilt, really, in this country with independence, because although independents have had a tough time over the last 10 years, I think so many of them have upped their game and really fought for their sort of space in the market. And... yeah, they're always the events I enjoy most when you do it in conjunction with an independent store like City Books, yeah.
So I'm talking about independent bookshops. We're going on to Independent Thought because of the three books you chose today, and we were just talking about this before. What I found really striking about all of them, although they're all quite different, is that they're all very much staking a claim for independent thought in very different ways.
Yeah.
I thought we could start with the one that I used to own myself as a Lions Teen Track imprint copy. But it's also the youngest writer and the oldest book of them all. The Outsiders by S.E. Hinton was published in 1967 when the author was just 18. Matt, could you explain to us, for those who haven't read it, what the book's about?
Yes, OK. The Outsiders is set in, I think, the 1960s in Oklahoma. It's about a gang of kids from the wrong side of the tracks. They're collectively known as greasers. It's quite a derogative term because they're the poor kids. A lot of them haven't got parents, but they're kind of like band of brothers. And, the interesting thing is, like, S.E. Hinton, I didn't know if that was a man or a woman or who was writing that when I read it, but yeah, she was a 19-year-old, so she was a teenage girl. But I had never felt as understood as a sort of teenage boy at all in any film or song or anything as I had done in this book. And I, even though I didn't grow up in the 1960s, I grew up in the 1980s in the East Midlands, so a kind of world away from 1960s Oklahoma, it just is the essence of teenageness in it. I mean, there's various things going on in the story, but for me, it's just the characterization. All the kids in it have strange names, like the narrator is Ponyboy Curtis, and there's also his brothers are Soda Pop and Dallas, and the sort of love interest is called Cherry Valance, and all the names sort of drip with this sort of poetry. And it's a book, although they're sort of a teenage gang of boys who get into fights with the rich kids known as the Socias, they're also boys who fall in love, who like poetry, who stare at sunsets, who reference Robert Graves. And it's just a really sort of romantic kind of mix of, I don't know, something like West Side Story or Catcher in the Rye, but with more heart. And it was just, it's not like the best, you know, when I go back to it now, it's definitely not the best written book in the world, but it was definitely the book that switched a light on in my brain and made me realise what books could be. Because up until that point, I suppose I read it when I was about 12, 13, and I had enjoyed books before that. I'd enjoyed people like Roald Dahl and all kinds of different authors. But I think this was the first one that realised that books weren't necessarily there to advance you or to do you good in the sort of teacherly sense. They could be another form of entertainment. They could be as thrilling as a computer game, as a rock song, as any film out there. They could be a comfort to you. I think it's no coincidence that I read it when I was having an unhappy time at school as well. And it was definitely one of those comfort reads. And when I was 24, over a decade later, when I was sort of in the midst of recovering from a nervous breakdown, it was one of the books that was on my bedroom shelf because I was back living in Newark-on-Trent with my parents. No access to a bookshop or anything, and so I had all my old childhood books, and it was the one I sort of pulled off the shelf a lot. And because I knew it so well, there's such a comfort in it. And I can even remember the first sentence, and I'm not one of those people who can remember sentences or quotes very well. And it's as I walked out of the movie theater, I had two things on my mind: Paul Newman and Ride Home. And I feel like that captures the essence of it for me, just in that one sentence, because it's kids with one eye on the stars and half stuck in the sort of reality of where they are. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful book. And you know, when you have one of your favourite books, you kind of forget that the author's a real person. And then I saw, you know, the other week, Essie Hinton's on Twitter. I thought, how could that be? She's sort of, it's part of mythology. I didn't realise. But yeah, and she wrote lots of other books, which I also like. There was a sort of sequence where I think it's called Tex and Rumblefish, which was made into a great film.
Rumblefish was another one on my bookshelf as well.
And that was then, this is now, that was the third one. But no, The Outsiders was one I always mention. I think because, you know, it's the ultimate outside a book. And it was also YA before there was such a thing as YA, before we had, you know, that as a sort of marketing category. The Outsiders was just such a purely, authentically teenage book, not just in its subject matter, but just the way it's written and in spirit. And yeah.
That's great.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Now, your non-fiction choice is Cosmos by the American popular scientist Carl Sagan. For listeners who may not have come across Carl before, could you tell us a bit about him?
Yeah, well, Carl Sagan, I suppose the simple way to describe it, he was basically like the Brian Cox of the 1980s. He was American. He was an incredibly intelligent man who managed to popularize science and physics and make it accessible to people who don't think of themselves necessarily as interested in that subject. As well as writing nonfiction, he also wrote fiction. He wrote a lot of science fiction. He wrote Contact, which was turned into a film with Jodie Foster. And I think the first thing that sort of appealed to me, because when you're sort of a teenage boy and you're actually, I was a bit older than teenage, early 20s, and you're sort of still fascinated about aliens and all those sort of things. He actually.
But you mean you've given up being fascinated by aliens?
I am still very fascinated. But he was the person who, you know, turned science instead of a sort of dry subject which had all the answers, it turned it into a kind of romantic subject which had all the questions. And I'm someone who was terrible at science. I grew up as the education system kind of makes you thinking. You know, you have to be a science person or an arts person. And I definitely grew up thinking I was an arts person. You know, going back to West Side Story, like, there's two gangs, the arts people versus the science people. And, you know, I'll embarrass myself now, but I got an F in GCSE science. And I think it's probably because I was, like, an hour late to the exam, but also...
I mean, that would probably contribute, yeah?
That would contribute. And, yeah, I got mainly A's, but then I've got this big glaring F on my GCSEs. And so that just underlined it, that I'm absolutely stubbornly not a scientific person. And I think I did have the world's worst science teachers, which put me off. So it was quite a few years after that I first encountered Cosmos and realised, actually, everyone's a science person. They just don't quite realise it. And it's one of those books that you read, and it's about everything from the possibility of alien life, formation of black holes. It's got ancient civilizations in there. We're talking about Egyptian hieroglyphics and ancient cultures, understanding of the universe, ancient Mesopotamia, all kinds of things. It's a life, the universe and everything kind of book. But it feels like a breeze to read because it's so accessible, the prose. So it's one of those books where it doesn't feel like hard work, yet by the end of it, you feel like you're twice as intelligent as you were going in.
This is what I really liked when I was looking at a lot of Sagan's work, actually, is that his real passion for the thought that ideas and intelligence, they're for everybody. They're not locked away. They're absolutely not in ivory towers. They're not for an elite. And I've seen him, you know, in recorded interviews say that, you know, you should never tell children it's a stupid question. But I think a book like Cosmos is about, as you say, unlocking it for people who believe that science isn't for them.
Yes, no, totally. And he's also, I find him... I get annoyed with myself talking about everyone as a therapeutic writer because I don't really know what that means. But I think there is a kind of like therapy in making yourself feel small. And he's a great writer. Reading Carl Sagan is almost like the equivalent of looking at the sky. You kind of get your sense of a place in time and space very easily. And it's one of those that you can dip into any place as well, which I always like. So you don't have to start at the beginning. You can sort of pick it up anywhere. And I've seen the TV series as well. And the TV series was great and iconic sort of 1980s show. But this has, you know, it must be about 200,000 words long. It's got so much in there. It's brilliant.
I really like that description of reading him as being like looking at the sky. On to slightly more fictional cities, to put it mildly, more fictional landscapes. Your third choice is Italo Calvino's Invisible Cities, which is a conversation between the explorer Marco Polo and Kublai Khan, who is the fifth great Khan of the Mongol Empire, I discovered. Polo's describing these 55 cities that he's visited as an explorer, but the book's really a lot more complicated than that, isn't it, in terms of its structure?
Yes, it is. There's a lot of dialogue between Kublai Khan and Marco Polo. But then you've also got each of the cities described. But the cities are weaved around themes of sort of place and space and love and stuff. But each city, you don't realise it necessarily on a first reading, but each city is basically a kind of hallucinatory, surreal version of Venice. It's each city is a kind of magical realist look at Venice. And what I love about this, but there's so many things I love about it, but A, I love the fact, and I'm almost addicted to writers who write in a sort of short form, lots of white space around it. Each city is so beautifully described, even in the translated versions, because I haven't read the Italian, because I don't read Italian.
Good reason.
And it feels like you're sort of reading a dream. I picked it up recently because it's one of those books I picked up recently, and I was quite kind of shocked to realise that one of these sort of beautiful, fantastical cities is called Melania. And I was thinking, that's quite an interesting thing to read in 2018. But it was one where, actually, the city of Melania is the one where everyone dies at a young age of ignorance, which I thought was kind of fitting for now. But there's something you get out of it wherever you reread it, because he's actually, even though there's no kind of narrative form as such, there's no beginning, middle and end, there's no plot or character development or any of that. Within each city, if you understand it like a poem, you can get different kinds of meaning and weave things out, and they sort of join together. And the reason I chose it for this podcast is, I mean, I like a lot of Italo Calvino stuff, and Invisible Cities is the uber example. It's just taught me that a book doesn't have to be anything. There's no obligation of what a book can be. It can be fiction, it can be non-fiction, it can be something in between, it can be totally surreal, it can have a plot, it doesn't have to have a plot, it can have as many characters as you can choose, it can be historical, but then it can pour lots of fiction and surrealism onto that history, and you can kind of, you're only limited by the walls of your imagination. And it's one of those books that, as a writer, if I've got writer's block, I'll just dip into and go to page 79 or whatever fantastical city is on there, read this, often it reads like science fiction, but read this poetic description of a city and its people. And it's one of those ones that I just think, oh yeah, I can take that extra leap and do that extra brave thing with the writing, because Italo Calvino has gone there before.
It's actually interesting because obviously he's got two people who were real in Marco Polo and Kublai Khan. And I think you were saying, I remember reading something you said about how to stop time, which obviously spans centuries. You know, the first thing you would not do in a creative writing class is be told to have your character meet William Shakespeare. And yet Tom does, and he meets Fitzgerald and several other people. He's involved in the Spanish Civil War and all sorts of things. So was that something that allowed you to take that jump into that part of your fiction? Was it, this is the inspiration?
Definitely, because like when I write How to Stop Time, as well as sort of like going through different time periods, he goes to a lot of different places. And it was very freeing to know that you don't have to be that true to the present, or the past, or any particular place. It can just be your dream version of everything. I think, you know, there's a certain type of historical novel which has to be, I think the readers would feel like they've been sort of shortchanged if it wasn't authentic and, you know, full of authentic dialogue and settings and sense and everything. And But my approach to writing about history is to use history as a sort of springboard into imagination. So you use history, real stuff, where it's useful or where it's fun. Like, for instance, in How to Stop Time, I talk about how all the children in Shakespearean England drink beer because it's safer to drink than water. That's an interesting fact. That seems beyond what you'd imagine. And so history's there, you know, to pick. But I sort of plunder it as a novelist and don't necessarily respect it always.
Sometimes you get to a larger truth by doing that, don't you, rather than...
And also, if a book's set over, say, 500 years, I think if you were literally totally authentic to the way people spoke in every era, it'd become almost... That would be more distracting than a bit of artistic license. So you sometimes do that thing that they have in films and TV where you just go with what sounds right. You don't have anyone in the 1600s, you know, saying LOL or talking about Snapchat.
Slightly off-piste question. I'm going back to Italo Calvino. If you could visit any of the cities, which would you go to? I'm assuming not Melania.
Not Melania. There's one, I think, called Venetia, which is towards the end, which all the rules of gravity don't apply. And, it's almost like that painting, Bosch, like Hieronymus Bosch, where the sort of staircases go on for everything. And it's just like it's him at his most sort of imaginative, where all the rules are broken and even gravity doesn't apply and everyone's wishes come true. But a lot of the cities you wouldn't want to go to because you're sort of making these sort of nightmarish statements about things and his own sort of claustrophobia. But actually, every time I talk about it, I think about it, it's made me actually want to go back to Venice. And I'm thinking of dragging our children to Venice because we've been resisting going to cities with our children. But I think now they're 10 and 9, we're going to get an easy jet to Venice.
That sounds lovely. For those of our listeners who really do want to read like a writer, talking about more about your reading during your writing process, what books do you borrow from?
Well, there's certainly authors that I'm always drawn to and influenced by. I don't know if it's because I'm a Yorkshire person, but all of the Brontes are my sort of go-to classics. Even Anne, I love The Tenant of Welfare Hall.
Oh, don't say even Anne like that, poor Anne.
I know. Well, yeah, she is a bit neglected in the old canon, but I feel like...
She's the hipster Bronte.
She's the hipster Bronte, absolutely.
The first album.
Yeah, Jane Eyre, The Yet, obviously from Charlotte, and Wuthering Heights, of course, and the poems of Emily Bronte. And just for their sheer romantic, quite individualistic, I suppose, but intensity, you know, the intensity, the power of writing. We talked earlier about books being a sort of retreat and a safe space, but those books, you can almost feel the sort of hurricane coming off from their sort of outwardly quiet appearance and demeanour, and then these sort of works of absolute forces of nature. So the Brontes, but also Graham Greene is another writer who I've always... I studied him at university and I was literally the only person who took the Graham Greene module in my master's degree. And it was just me, and the tutor didn't really like me very much. I could sense it through the course, and I thought I wrote the best essay I've ever written, and he gave me 69%, which was just one less from being, you know, whatever you get, distinction. Anyway, sorry, I shouldn't bring that grudge up. But
I like it. There's nothing like a long-held grudge.
Graham Greene.
Graham Greene is a good man for a long-held grudge as well.
Although a lot of his books are sort of miserable and about sort of Catholic guilt and all of that, I just like his style. You know, it's his style that's drawn to me. Like, he was great at comparing solid real-world things with abstract things. Like, there's a line, I think it's in The Power and the Glory, which is he drank the whiskey down like damnation, and just suddenly just comparing, you know, turns the simple act of drinking into something sort of universal. And spiritual. And just again, it's a sheer sort of power of writing.
We've been talking about the books that you recommend to adult readers. What's the book that you enjoy reading most to your children?
Ah, good question. I recently read Boy by Roald Dahl, which was very good as an adult reading it to them, because our children are very, they've been brought up in a very sort of soft, liberal, kind of Brighton way. They're homeschooled. They've got it quite good. And so reading something like Boy, which was obviously about Roald Dahl's experience of his sort of private school, where boarding school, where he, you know, the kids were basically tortured, you know, they were beaten and everything else. It put the fear of God into our children, and they suddenly, oh yes, we're really grateful that you're not like that. What else? Well, my daughter just loves everything with animals in it. So she's reading, her favourite author is Megan Ricks, who writes these great stories, often in historical settings, but with animals as the way into the story. And I forget the title now, but there's one set in the Great Fire of London, I think, with dogs maybe in the Great Fire. But that was fun. And we also recently read Spike Milligan's poetry to them, and they enjoyed that a lot. All kinds of people. The Liz Pichon books, the Tom Gates, they're also big in our household. So, yes, I basically can't choose. Children's books for me are the ultimate fiction. I mean, I love writing for children because I think children are the best readers. I think, you know, we talk about what you can't write in a children's book, but actually I think writing for children and reading children's books is often more freeing, because children's imaginations are just willing to go anywhere.
Do you find it very different writing for children from writing for adults?
Every book's different to each other. So you're definitely aware when you're writing a children's book that it is for a certain age group or whatever. But I feel like actually writing for children made me a better writer for adults, because I think it's going back to that thing I was saying in Invisible Cities about having that freedom. Because all you want as a writer and reader, I think, is freedom. You know, freedom that you don't always necessarily get in reality. And writing for children gave me that freedom to just go with the fantasy, to go with whatever is most interesting to you at that certain point in time. So, it definitely, you know, when I write for adults now, I almost forget that they're adults and just sort of see them as older, slightly uglier versions of children.
Well, we're keeping you away from both your own children and hopefully from a surprise trip to Venice, because today's also your birthday as well, isn't it?
It is, yes.
Happy
Speaking
birthday.
Speaking of getting older, yes. 43 years old, I know. It's kind of... I'm okay with it. I'm actually... One of the things I realised researching Notes on a Nervous Planet is that worrying about getting older is a sign that you're young, because... There's a lot of research now, but actually the people who worry most about ageing are in their 20s, and the older you get, the more resigned to it. So I'm sort of trying to stay worried about it, because that means I'm young.
I'm about the same age as you, and I'm still worrying, so we're in it together, I think, at the moment. Well, happy birthday, and I hope
thank
the rest
you,
of the day
Anna.
Is brilliant for you. And thank you so much for coming in. We really appreciate
that
it.
That was a pleasure.
Matt Haig's Notes on a Nervous Planet is out now and published by Canongate. Read Like a Writer was brought to you by Faber and Faber, Serpent's Tale and Canongate, and was presented by me, Anna Fielding. To get a full list of what this week's author recommended, visit acast.com/readlikeawriter. And we'd love to hear what you have to say too, so do tweet us at readlikeapod.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.